This is a repeat edition of Soundcheck. From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. They say you can't judge a book by its cover, but this book... This book might be an exception. It's called Unknown Pleasures, and it's an inside look at the brief, influential, and ultimately tragic story of the English post-punk band called Joy Division, and it comes to us from the band's bass player, Peter Hook. The cover is all black. The title on the spine is black. Black semi-gloss letters on a black matte cover. Even the edges of the pages are black, so when you hold the book, it's like you're holding a black box. In other words, it's perfect for Joy Division, a band that made intense, emotional music with dark lyrics, and a band that ended up with a dark story, with their lead singer committing suicide just as they were on the verge of their first U.S. tour. But along the way, you get a tale full of humor, dopey pranks, perseverance, fights, friendship, and a band that changed the sound of rock. Peter Hook will join us in just a moment. First, though, let's hear a song from Trixie Whitley. She's a singer, songwriter, and musician, and the daughter of the late blues rock guitarist Chris Whitley. Trixie's new album attracted a lot of attention from you folks when we offered it as a live stream on our website last week. She'll play a set for us later in the show. Right now, here's Trixie Whitley playing Gradual Return in the Soundcheck studio.
Mama's perfumes, it's way too soon. You've got your sister made in name. Faithfulness never tasted the same. And forgetfulness doesn't run through our veins. But this is my gradual return. This is my gradual return. Ooh, 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 yeah. Woke up in the night from a lightning's forces. As if a guest of beauty. Beauty, mistress. I listen to the sound of the old town songs. An elderly story soaking in a young one's bones. Faithfulness never tasted the same.
That's Trixie Whitley with a song called Gradual Return. You can hear the full song on our website at soundcheck.org. And in a little while, we'll hear Trixie playing and talking a bit about her terrific new record. But right now, we take you to Manchester, England in 1978, where TV host Tony Wilson introduces a brand new band called Joy Division.
Seeing as how this is the program which previously brought you first television appearances from everything from the Beatles to the Buzzcocks, would you like to keep our hand in and keep you informed of the most interesting new sounds in the Northwest? This, Joy Division, is the most interesting new sound we've come across in the last 6 months. They're a Manchester band, with the exception of the guitarist, who comes from Salford. Very important difference. They're called Joy Division. This number is Shadow Play.
To the center of the city where a rose meet waiting for you. To the depths of the ocean where a hope sank sitting for you.
The British band Joy Division existed for less than 3 years, from January 1978 to May of 1980, but its influence on music over the last 30-odd years has been enormous, heard in the sound of bands from U2 to Interpol. Joy Division's story is also a tragic one. The group's singer, Ian Curtis, took his own life just days before the group was scheduled to make its first American tour. The other three members soldiered on under the name New Order, changing from the dark, intense sound of Joy Division to something more dance-oriented. New Order went on to rule the radio in the 1980s, but Joy Division never really went away. Peter Hook played bass in both bands, and he's now telling his part of the story in a new book called Unknown Pleasures, Inside Joy Division. Peter Hook, welcome to Soundcheck.
Hello, how are you?
Good. I kind of felt like I needed to do this Joy Division 101 thing, just because it seems like people who read this book, you know, you're sort of expecting them to know at least the bare bones of the story going in.
Yeah, I mean, it does help. The thing is that, as you said in your intro, the shocking thing is that considering we were only a band for 2.5 years and we were only professional for 6 months, if you can call professional being on $20 a week. I think it's a bit more of a dream. I think it was the title we liked more than the wages. Yeah, I mean, the fact that even now, 35 years since I began as a musician, you're still quoted as being one of the most inspirational bands of all time. And rightly so, New Order were much more commercially successful. Mm-hmm. But Joy Division, very surreptitiously, managed in the same way the Doors have, I suppose, managed to keep that class. And it's always the sort of band that people look to for inspiration. So.
And even as New Order went from strength to strength with all these hit singles, there was always this kind of interest in where the band had come from. So at this point, we have 2 feature films. There's 24-Hour Party People and Control.
Yes.
A number of books. So what did you feel you needed to bring to the table with this book?
Well, I suppose, as it says in the title, mine's the inside story. And I think the odd thing is that when people write about it, they tend to look on the surface and not what's behind it. The thing about it is that we did come from a very dark, gloomy period in English history. The 70s in England were very, very difficult, particularly in Manchester. The whole culture, the way the industry was shaped in Manchester and centred in Manchester, was disappearing. So it was a very depressing time. Politically, it was a very depressing time as well. It was right in the middle of Margaret Thatcher's reign, and there was a lot of upset with the miners and the cotton industry disappearing. It was a tough time for England and for Manchester in particular. So you did come from that. The strange thing was that when Joy Division finished, and the only reason that Joy Division did finish was because of Ian's death, we made a deal between ourselves that if any member left, we wouldn't carry on as the band. And then you moved into New Order, and New Order coincided with the 80s, which became a much more vibrant and brighter time. And as we got older, I think that's one of the things, you know, that sort of hopelessness and helplessness you feel of youth.
Yeah.
We started to leave it behind. So, yeah, things did get a little lighter and brighter. Thank God.
Did you leave all that stuff behind, or was there were there diaries, tour notes, set lists?
That's the interesting one. What happened was when, I mean, the thing is that Bernard, Stephen and I have talked about Joy Division ad infinitum. So a lot of the stories in the book have been relayed by all of us at various points of our career, because every time you do an interview as New Order, it was impossible for them not to mention Joy Division. So there has been a lot written about the group. Every time I read or watched anything to do with it, they always played up the dark side, the intensity, the gothic overtones, the deification of Ian. And I was, you know, you think to yourself, hang on a minute, he wasn't all like that. Yeah. There were certain aspects of it that were very fun, very hard work, very human.
Well, here in the States, I mean, of course, as Joy Division, you guys never got here.
No, there was many places we never got. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we were literally just starting.
Right. But here in the States, I mean, Joy Division was essentially known for a single song, and that is this one, Love Will Tear Us Apart.
Love will tear us apart again. Love.
Joy Division's single, Love Will Tear Us Apart, sung by the late Ian Curtis, featuring Peter Hook, my guest on Soundcheck, playing the bass, as he would go on to do in the subsequent band New Order as well. The story, I mean, for all that you know how it's going to end, if you're a Joy Division fan, and it will end badly in tragedy, is a very funny story along the way.
Yes, I think that was the aspect that you wanted to get over. You know, what happened was that I read one book too many about Joy Division, which came out just before I started, and I thought, oh, no, come on, this is going too far, and I thought, right, now's the time to tell it from the inside. Mm-hmm. Anton Corbijn, when he did the Control film, he had the same problem, because he was facing the thing that I had when I was doing the book, you know, a nasty ending.
Right.
And his idea was to put the ending at the start and get the nastiness out of the way, because he felt that the rest of the story was actually very valid, because it was about six people if you count the record company, Tony Wilson, who worked very hard, very well together, and really did change the rules of independent music, not only musically but also culturally.
Mm-hmm.
And he felt that story was joyous.
Well, and the key word there might be independent. I mean, the whole DIY thing.
Came from punk, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We never had any money.
Right.
So when these London record labels came up offering money, we were like, we don't trust this. It doesn't seem right. You know, we were so used to being poor. It seemed logical, shall we say. And once we met Tony Wilson, he was a very well-known TV celebrity in the north of England.
Mm-hmm.
Once you met him, his infectious enthusiasm caught you, and his ideas were all based in Manchester. You know, Manchester Major will use Manchester to take it to the world. So the thing was is that it was about sharing and celebrating the joyous part of the group. For me to do the book was about the struggle that the four of us faced, how well we got on, and how well we got on with that job, how the music progressed so quickly.
And you guys were basically learning as you went.
Yes. It does frighten me, you know, the part in the book when I went to the Sex Pistols concert.
Mm-hmm.
When I went in the door, I was a normal 9-to-5 civil servant with weekends off and time off for good behaviour. And then when I walked out, I was a completely obsessed musician.
This is the famous concert in Manchester, June of 1976.
Yes.
They say 50 people showed up.
That's
and
right.
40 of them started bands.
Correct.
I
wouldn't
Fall,
be surprised.
Buzzcocks, you guys.
Simply Red, Frantic Elevators, Slaughter and the Dogs, the Drones. It was amazing roll call. The inspiration at that gig was completely intangible with what you were listening to. Why you listened to the Sex Pistols and thought, 40 people thought, oh, we could do that. It's just ridiculous. But the scary thing from my point of view was, what would have happened if you hadn't have gone? Oh, God.
Mm.
You know, that really, considering I've been a musician for 35 years now and still love it, is a scary thought to what could have happened if you hadn't have made it. And Bernard and I weren't trained. We weren't musicians. We'd never been in a band before. We'd never written a song. Hardly Bernard had played the guitar, because his mum and dad got him one for Christmas, but I'd never had a musical instrument in my hands. And there I was, a musician who didn't own a musical instrument and didn't have a clue about writing music. And you know what? The great thing was is that that didn't seem to matter.
Right.
It didn't stop you in any way. It was all about capturing the spirit, expressing yourself. And what happened was that it was a reaction against old established rock stars.
Mm.
Get rid of the old farts, as we said. In England, now I'm delighted they didn't, now that I am an old fart.
We're speaking with Peter Hook, the bassist from Joy Division, subject of his new book, Unknown Pleasures, and later bassist for New Order as well. You write in the book that the first moment when it occurs to you, hang on, we've got something happening here, is when you're in a sound check for a gig later that day and you're playing Transmission.
We'd just written Transmission, and our songwriting was getting better and better and better. Now, the strange thing is that when you're in there, it's a much subtler progression. You know, from your first song to your last, you can see that there's that's a gulf. But the ones in between, it's quite a natural progression. And what happened was we'd written Transmission. We were happy with it. And probably then we were on to the next one. you know, what that might have been, disorder or atmosphere, da-da-da. So it sort of fitted in quite well. It didn't stick out to us that much. But we went to the sound check, and it was the first time we played it over a PA. We were using a sound guy called Oz McCormick, who became our proper sound man. So we were getting a great crack at the PA. There was nobody holding you back, and he was really, you know, mixing it so it sounded fantastic. We played it, and every band in the place, there was about seven bands on, actually stopped, looked round, and then walked towards us. And we were like, what's going on? Why are they doing this? And, you know, those nervous looks you were sort of sharing between each other. And it was like that first moment when you thought, oh my God, we might actually have something here. The history of Joy Division was just based on a love for the music. It was long before any commercial or any commercial pressures came into us. We really were just there for the love of doing it. We never earned any money as Joy Division. There were no arguments about money because there was nothing there. So it was actually a very pure period and very focused. Everyone was very happy doing what they were doing, each individual, Bernard, Stephen and I, with Rob Gretton, Tony Wilson, the record label, and Ian. And the only thing that dragged us down was Ian's illness. And then Ian's, I don't know whether it was a symptom of his illness, that his relationship with his wife, he was married very young.
Very young,
had a baby very young as well. And then got a well-known mistress. Mm-hmm. So he was in a very, very complicated situation with this awful, debilitating illness.
Well, and epilepsy back then still had a kind of stigma to it.
Yeah, I mean, there was the possessed by the devil type thing, and also the strangest thing is that I found it was a scene they actually left out of the Joy Division documentary, was that they took Ian's prescription for his illness to a modern-day epilepsy specialist and got him to analyse it. And the modern-day epilepsy specialist, first look, when he looked at it, and he said, oh, my God, he said, this was guaranteed to kill him. Mm. You know, it was that strong and potent, the mix of uppers and downers they were giving him for the treatment in 1977, just not recognised in any way today. So it was terrible. The guy was in a complete maelstrom, compounded by the illness. And I think because of the work and the enthusiasm that he'd put in before he got ill, and while his illness was degenerating, he really didn't want to let you down. And I think, you know, for us to go to him and say, Ian, are you all right? I think he just looked at you and thought, I know what I'm going to say here. Yeah, I'm all right. Don't worry about me.
Stay tuned for more with Peter Hook, up next on Soundcheck. Feeling like you've heard this all before? You're not going crazy. It's a repeat edition of Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer.
We're speaking with Peter Hook, the bassist from Joy Division and later New Order, about his new book called Unknown Pleasures Inside Joy Division. One of the most telling lines in the book comes very late on, although you've built up to it over the course of a couple of hundred pages, is when you say that you could have and perhaps should have called the book, "He Said He Was All Right, So We Carried On."
Yeah, exactly as I said before, I think the thing is that the passion and the enthusiasm and the hard work, sheer hard work you'd put in to get the group where it was, the greatest frustration to Ian was that it was looked like that that was going to be the thing that stopped you. And he hated it, mm-hmm. and he fought it tooth and nail. He really did. And the thing was is that he didn't want to let us down. And when we went to him, as I said before, he would just look at you, and he must be thinking, I don't want to hurt this guy, I don't want to let him down. He's worked as hard as I have. And it was such a relief for me and for Bernard and Steve and Rob and Tony to hear from him, I'm all right, don't worry, I may have had a fit, I may have tried to kill myself, I may have done a self-harming episode, but I'm all right, don't worry. You know, and you were like, oh, great, because it was like perfect cop-out
right.
for us. And we couldn't deal with it. It was a very, very difficult situation. You were so young, and down the pecking order of experts, doctors, parents, etc., you were quite low down. But, I mean, it doesn't stop the guilt. And I think the odd thing was is that I'd sort of convinced myself when I came to write the book that Ian got ill at the end of Joy Division. You know, that was when the epilepsy appeared. When I actually looked at the dates, went through the fan sites, got everything together, I thought, oh my God, he actually got ill pretty much at the start.
Well, there's a scene very early on in the book. It's before there's any hint of epilepsy, of fits, self-harming, or any of the stuff that would come later. You describe Ian in a club kicking broken glass.
And, yeah, and I mean, it's
in retrospect.
It was unusual behavior, but it was a difficult night. It was a very, very difficult night. We'd been fighting with one of the support bands. It was very competitive, really competitive edge between all the bands that were involved in the punk scene. And you were scrabbling and fighting for gigs. There was a wonderful bit of togetherness at the start. But once you all got going, then it became like every man for himself. It was like pirates, just completely normal, I think. And we ended up really fighting for your performance every night. This particular evening, we were very, very wound up because some band had been trying to usurp us off the top spot. Ian had got a little bit drunk and went bananas. Now, it's strange, as a group member, the first time, I was like, wow, yeah, it's like Iggy Pop. Whoa, you know, and Ian was a great, great fan of Iggy and the Stooges. He really was, you know, it really appealed to him, that whole thing. And then you were going, oh, my God, it's going a bit far now, when he started smashing the tables and rolling in the broken glass, and there was nobody there.
Right.
You know, I mean,
it wasn't
about
a show.
Six people. He seemed a little bit possessed.
Yeah.
And suppose, maybe looking back with hindsight, you'd maybe say that it might have been the start of his illness.
Yeah. And you also talk, just a little bit after that, about the song No Love Lost, and especially there's a kind of a spoken word verse there.
So long, sitting here, sitting here, the warning, waiting for the tick to run. We've been moving around in different situations, knowing that the time would come. Just to see you torn apart, witness to your empty heart. I need it, I need it, I need it. Through the wire screen, the eyes of those standing outside looked in at her, as into the cage of some rare creature in a zoo. In the hand of one of the assistants, she saw the same instrument as they had that morning, inserted deep into her body. She shuddered instinctively. No life at all in the house of dolls. No, 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 no.
You know, again, if we had known then what we know now, you would look at these
words. Yeah, I mean,
words
there were a lot of lyrics that you could look at with hindsight and say. But the interesting thing is that, you know, a lot of your music and lyrics, etc., and the mood you put into the songs, you sort of feel that they come subconsciously. And again, when you talk to Ian, he was the nicest guy in the world, the most generous man, a wonderful, wonderful guy, and that odds the contradiction there, I suppose, could puzzle you. Mm-hmm. If I was going to, you know, if I was in court defending myself here, I'd be going, well, there was a puzzlement there, you know. He acted one way and wrote another. Mm-hmm. And that did puzzle us all. I mean, Peter Savile, who was our graphic designer, who was a partner in Factory Records, it was him that said it the most, if only we'd have read the lyrics. But it wasn't like that while you were doing it. And I mean, literally, it was his health that made everything difficult, you know.
We're talking about the singer Ian Curtis from the band Joy Division with the band's bassist Peter Hook, author of the new book Unknown Pleasures Inside Joy Division, a relatively short-lived English post-punk band of the late 70s. The singer Ian Curtis killed himself just days before the band was to make its first American tour, and when the other three members of the band eventually came to the United States, it was as New Order. Peter Hook is the bass player of both bands and author of the new book Unknown Pleasures Inside Joy Division. After Ian's death, Rob Gretton, mm-hmm. the manager of the band, said Joy Division will be really big in 10 years' time,
yeah.
Which has turned out to be actually kind of an understatement.
Yes, they are still huge 30 years on, and he was absolutely right. I think he saw a direct comparison to The Doors. And with Ian, and especially with Jim Morrison, and that sort of appreciation The Doors got after they finished Round the World. You know, they were big in America, but I'm not too sure they were big around the rest of the world. And he was absolutely right. I mean, you know, it wasn't much solace at the time, really. You know, we'd sort of got up to the musical Snakes and Ladders board, and then all of a sudden, the three of us were back down without our very close friend and colleague. And someone who was very, very instrumental, excuse the pun, in forming the music. So literally once you'd got to New Order, you had to re-educate and relearn and find a new way of writing music. And I must admit that for me, it was always easy doing the music in Joy Division. And then when we got to New Order, the gap that Ian had left was always so big, it always made it feel a bit like a wonky table. Occasionally you'd get it to stick, but then it would go loose again, and it was very frustrating, actually. It took us a long, long time to exercise his ghost, I suppose you'd have to say. So it was a very strange feeling.
Do you think, I mean, this is complete speculation, I know I'm asking you to engage in here, but if Ian had come to the States, if Joy Division had made it to that tour, that's where you guys, when it was coming here to the States, guys first heard that kind of dance music.
Yeah, thing. I mean, it revolutionized Manchester with the Hacienda.
Yeah,
we took the whole ethos of clubbing and dance music from New York back to Manchester and turned it into a worldwide phenomenon.
What do you think Ian's response to that would have been?
He was so excited about coming to America because the American bands were the ones that were his idols, Velvet Underground,
Iggy Pop
and the Stooges, you know. It was always these, the Doors, these were his big, big heroes. And I do think that he would have caught on to the spirit, maybe relaxed and enjoyed it more. I mean, the funny thing about New Order was that once we got to America, we never really went anywhere else, to be honest with you. And our whole career then became American-centric, and that was what turned New Order into a huge success, was the concentration on America. Because, you know, Americans love it when you work. They really do. They actually recognise that ethos of hard work. So if we'd have got here, but we didn't, and that's something we can't change. I mean, what amuses me or what amazes me really is that I don't think that musically we would have changed. You know, Bernard's interest in dance music and electronic hardware, synthesizers, etc., sequences wouldn't have changed if Ian would have lived. Steve's interest in drum machines and drum synthesizers wouldn't have changed. So really what you're thinking is that the music would have changed as the times changed.
Right.
And Ian would have been singing on Blue Monday, which would have been a great, great thought for me. It does intrigue me that, especially as it's sort of 30 years of Blue Monday. This year as well.
So will there be a New Order book?
Oh, yeah, dear. The interesting thing about that is that I wasn't going to do a New Order book because I felt that there were many, many things that I was ashamed of during that. You know, just the normal rock and roll things that stupid boys indulge in. And it was a completely different story and a completely different feel to the Joy Division mm-hmm. episode. What happened was when the band reformed without me, we fell out spectacularly since the split up in 2006, and it shows no sign of abating. Or even this week has been unbelievable. I'm very flattered by the attention I'm getting from my ex-colleagues. I really am, considering they've been working together for over a year and say they neither need me nor care. It certainly doesn't seem that way when you read the interviews. They still seem to be completely obsessed. But the problem is then is that I thought, in a funny way, by not doing a new order book, I was protecting us all. And you feel a bit betrayed, you know, that to me, the way they did it completely behind my back without even my knowledge or consent just doesn't seem right. And so it caused a lot of resentment and anger. And then I thought, yeah, f*** it. I'll do the book. I suppose that my career has changed, and I must admit that being an author does have a gravitas to it that a musician just doesn't. I know for a fact that my mother would be so happy, and that, God rest her soul, that now that I'm an author, if she'd have lived to see it, than she ever was about me being a musician.
Well, can I say that this book, Unknown Pleasures, is one of the handsomest books I have ever seen. Black cover, black side of the pages. So when you hold it, it's like just holding a plain black box. There is writing on the spine, but it's black on black. So you have to kind of hold it up to the light to read it. Very, very handsome book.
Very Joy Division. It's beautiful. I mean, I was knocked out when I saw it, to be honest.
It's beautiful.
It is. It's wonderful.
The book is called Unknown Pleasures, Inside Joy Division by the longtime bassist Peter Hook from both Joy Division and the successor band New Order. You say at one point, you must have many favorites, but at one point in the book, you do point to Insight.
Yes, one of my favorite bass riffs, and a typical Joy Division song in that it doesn't really have a chorus, but Ian very, very cleverly sort of writes a chorus into the verse vocal so that you've got these wonderful vocal hooks. He also has an amazing use of onomatopoeia that I've picked out when I came to sing his lyrics. I never really fully appreciated it while I was just playing the bass. But when you have to sing it, you realise that the delivery of it, he actually delivers a wonderful chorus, very unusually, hidden in the song, which makes it very, very memorable. It's also a great use of the drum synthesizer by Steve, a very sparse but really atmospheric guitar from Bernard, and it's probably archetypal Joy Division to me.
The song is Insight from the album Unknown Pleasures. The book is Unknown Pleasures. Peter Hook, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
This is Soundcheck.
Guess your dreams always there. They don't rise up just to sand. But I don't care anymore. I've lost some room to want more. I'm not afraid, not at all. I watch them all as they fall. But I
Up next, we'll hear more music from singer-songwriter Trixie Whitley, and we'll talk with her about her musical family, her work with the group Black Dub, and about mailing Bootsy Collins mixtapes and friendship bracelets. Stay with us. This is Soundcheck. Having a feeling of déjà vu? Good reason for it. This is a repeat edition of Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. The singer and songwriter Trixie Whitley has made quite an impression on us here at Soundcheck. You may have heard her here in the studio a few years back singing with Daniel Lanois in the group Black Dub, or you may have listened to our recent Check Ahead album stream of her brand new record called Fourth Corner. Actually, many of you did just that and told us how much you liked it. Well, now Trixie is back in the Soundcheck studio to play some of those songs for us live. We'll catch up with her in a moment, but first, here she is with a song called Oh the Joy. It's Trixie Whitley, live on Soundcheck.
Thanks. ¶¶
shines through your soul like the souls of a child's lullaby. And our mountaintop thoughts weigh heavy on our hearts. But it's sunny and stormy. I was born to listen to the oldest voices. But when the world turns silent and is filled with things that speak noble wilderness, pages unspoken, but a thousand dreams within they softly burn. While the shore can rise the level of our defeat, the hour turns dull when knowing the shade of our speech. But it's carved in stone. I was born to listen to the oldest voices. But when the world turns silent and is filled with things that speak noble wilderness,
Trixie Whitley playing the guitar, singing, jingling a little bit too. We hear your bracelets.
I'll take them off. Sorry about that.
No, that's fine. It's nice. Adds a little bit of the percussive sound to that live performance of "Oh the Joy." Good to have you back here in the Soundcheck studio.
Yeah, thank you so much. Thanks a lot.
So the album, the new album's called Fourth Corner, which you know, there's lots of meanings to that phrase. You know, there's a couple of places in the U.S. where four states meet, and they call. So, what did you mean by it?
I mean, it's definitely a metaphor for me. It does have to do a little bit also with the four corners. You know, I mean, that's kind of where it came from. But, you know, to me, actually, the title track, Fourth Corner, I wrote in Morocco, on a trip to Morocco. And I think it's a lot of, like, kind of, you know, I grew up, I had quite a nomadic upbringing. And I think most of my childhood, I kind of struggled with, like, knowing where, trying to figure out where I was from and all that. And then, you know, the song Fourth Corner really just kind of, I feel like it actually was like this moment where I, like, felt like I made peace with these different, all these different facets of my being, and where I also just wanted to embrace that kind of in a philosophical sense towards the record too, and also towards humanity of, like, you know, I like to refer it to, like, say, the four seasons, you know, where they're so drastically different, but they're so connected, and they're so, you know, they're so parallel to each
and
other.
And sort of an inevitability of one.
Yeah,
following the
so
other.
It's like
yeah.
embracing these, you know, the constant change and allowing them, and the beauty of, like, you know, and then I guess on an emotional sense, like, you know, the beauty between, like, love and rage, how they quite often can go together, that's okay. You know, and I just wanted to, like, express that on this record, that this that all of these facets kind of need each other, and that.
So, I mean, growing up both in Europe, your mom's Belgian, right?
Yeah.
And here in the States, your dad's the late singer-songwriter Chris Whitley. So you were kind of betwixt and between home-wise. I mean, are you home now? Do you consider New York home?
I do. You know, it's weird. I've always considered New York more as home. And I think slightly because, you know, the majority of people that live here aren't even really from here. So yeah, it's a little, yeah. It's like there's kind of like this common like sense, and that's, you know, just
immigrants.
Yeah, I mean, that personally I feel quite comforted by that, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, I guess, you know, I also have always felt kind of as a, I guess at the same time as quite an alien too, and again, like I think just kind of finding peace with like being home wherever I am really has to do with feeling at home within myself, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's just kind of an overall thing that most people can connect with, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So.
We're speaking with Trixie Whitley. Her new album is called Fourth Corner, so the title kind of a metaphor for finding your place, being at peace, being at home. And yet the album is not, you know, this kind of kind of wimpy singer-songwriter. I mean, there's some real gritty stuff here.
I
like a lot of the percussion. I mean, the rhythms. You started as your first instrument were drums, right?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's still like my first love in a lot of ways, too. I mean, I feel like, I mean, I guess technically my first instrument would be my voice, but drums is, and I notice, you know, I'm totally self-taught, and I notice, like, even within my, you know, piano playing and my guitar playing, that I really approach it more as a percussive instrument. And I think just ever since I was a kid, like, I just was really kind of rhythmically inclined to approach music and any form of expression through, like, a rhythmic kind of sense. So, yeah, I still love it, too. So.
Now, as I mentioned, the last time you were here, you were singing with Daniel Lanois' band Black Dub. Which is kind of, you know, I think I first heard of your dad, Chris Whitley, through Daniel, mentioning him. So this would have been going back a few years, because they worked together, didn't
they?
So
I mean, they didn't work together. They knew each other.
They knew each other. And Daniel was, he was a big supporter of your father's
in the beginning,
music,
yeah, like his first record.
Yeah. So when he called you, I mean, in a sense, it was like the wheel had come full circle in a way.
Yeah, and you know what? Actually, it's kind of nice that you bring that up, because that to me is also part of the metaphor of Fourth Corner in a way. You know, it's like how the circle just comes back. You know, and like there's just certain things in life that, you know, like you can't deny that they just, there is this kind of ebb and flow. And I think the story with Daniel is like, it's a pretty crazy example of that, you know, how like, I mean, we first met when I was 3 years old. I was, you know, in his studio in New Orleans during the recordings of my dad's first record, and then re-met like, you know, 18 years later, and then just this whole other kind of chapter unfolded. But Dan and, you know, I mean, the Whitleys were out of touch for that entire time, you know? So it's just, it is a wild kind of thing. And even, like, you know, Daryl that play, you know, the bass player on the record, like, I mean, he used to, like, change my diapers as a kid. And then, like, you know, to then, like,
too
meet
much
him.
Information!
No, I think it's cool. I mean, I was just like, whoa, this is, no, I didn't mean that in, like, a gross way or anything. More in, like, a cool way of, like, whoa.
I know.
From, like, holding me as a baby to, like, playing bass together, you know,
yeah.
I mean, just like
it is. That's Daryl Johnson,
the
bass player, and Daniel Lanois, for folks who are trying to place the name, the guy who produced U2 and Peter Gabriel and Bob Dylan, did not produce this record, but you did work with Thomas Bartlett,
yes,
who also goes under the name Dove Man, and who has played our piano there many a time.
Yeah.
And, you know, turned out to be a very interesting collaboration, too.
Yeah, I'm so thrilled I made that choice. You know, I think it was really important as well after the Black Dub experience to, you know, and I went the last couple of years, I was going through some kind of just more like industry-related stuff that I had to get out somehow. And, you know, I think it was really important for me with my first album because there's always like this reference of like, you know, as being a Whitley, you know, my dad, and then Lanwha, to make a really statement that was as true as possible to my own musical identity, which I'm obviously, you know, I think just with the first record, there's no better time to make that statement. That's how I felt. You know, Thomas was, we've actually been like super close friends for years before the whole Black Dub story started. Actually, I used to waitress in the city, and Thomas and Nico Mooley and stuff, they would like pick up my checks when I was sick and stuff. Like, I mean, we were really tight. And but there was also this really freeing thing of, you know, that he's closer to my age.
Yeah.
So there it was nice to just have
he never changed your diapers.
No, I'm sorry. No, he never did. He just,
That's important in a producer.
Yeah.
You want to maintain a little bit of a distance.
Yeah, I want to make sure that they didn't change my diapers this time. No, but yeah, so Thomas was, you know, we just have such musical chemistry, and I really feel like for the future that we'll continue to collaborate. I mean, it just feels like such a wonderful, like, musical partnership, you know, and just this dialogue where it's also like fun, but still has this like just vast need to explore to the very extreme.
Mm-hmm.
And where we challenge each other, you know, because I think like his strengths are often my weaknesses and the other way around too. And that's a really complimentary thing to like have in that kind of musical dialogue, you know, so.
So Thomas Bartlett producing the record Fourth Corner from my guest, Trixie Whitley. She's playing for us mostly at the guitar so far, but now moving over to the piano. And this next song is called Breathe You in My Dreams. Once again, it's live music from Trixie Whitley on Soundcheck.
Conflicts with the oceans.
silver shadows walking by my side. Silver shadows walking by our side. But I ain't coming. I ain't coming home tonight. I ain't coming home tonight. But I'm
once again, Trixie Whitley, live on Soundcheck. The song is Breathe You In My Dreams. Her new album is called Fourth Corner. Trixie at our piano for that last song, and boy, that really is a beautiful tune. When you play them like this, solo guitar, solo piano, I assume that's pretty close to how they were when you wrote them?
Yeah, I write them. Yeah, some of this stuff, definitely. The songs I played in particular, those are ones that were written in the more, I guess, kind of more traditional way or something. But
as opposed to going into the studio and working out
riffs
and
stuff. I like working a lot with like beatboxes and stuff too. Mm. With like drum machines and like starting stuff off riffs and then mm-hmm. just building more off of this. But these were more kind of like, you know, sit down and just get the song done.
Right.
But
you know, about a year ago, Bootsy Collins was sitting in that chair that you're now in.
Oh, God.
And I understand you are or were a big Bootsy Collins fan.
I have a really funny story, actually. Yeah. Bootsy was, like, my first ever, like, idol.
Your musical crush?
Oh, yeah, totally. I actually...
Did you see him with Parliament Funkadelic or as Bootsy?
No, as Bootsy. And I think, actually... when I was about like 6 years old or something, my mom took me to this show of his with two friends of hers, and like it was jam packed. I mean, it seemed probably like there were a lot more people than there were because I was 6 years mm-hmm. old. But her two friends, like we got all the way up to the front row, and one of her friends like picked me up on his shoulders, and like so the whole show. I was checking it up, like, on the front row on my
on a grown man's shoulders,
yeah.
Right?
And just flipping out, you know, actually talking about...
Was it your first concert?
Talking about diapers. There's the guitar player with the
diapers. Come on.
The guitar player with the diapers. I was just like, whoa, this is, like, off the hook. But at the end of the set, Bootsy, like, picked me up off of this, like, guy's shoulders. And, like, we danced on stage until the end of the set. And I just, from then on, like, had this, like, obsession with him. And, like, started sending him fan packages. Like, I would make mixtapes to send to Bootsy with, like, music that I felt like he had to check out. Mm. And, like, and I would make these, I would braid these little, like, you know, like, bracelets. And, like, I would make jewelry for him. And so I would just, like, for a year, I sent all these, like, fan packages to Bootsy and never heard back. And my heart was seriously broken that he never wrote me back. But,
But three restraining orders later...
God, it's just, yeah, I'm still really, really into it. Anyways, he's definitely, yeah.
Well, you know, watching you play the guitar pieces especially, you know, there's a little kind of, the way you strike the bass strings of the guitar, you know, there's a little bit of the funk influence there.
I guess, yeah. I always say I play more bass on guitar than anything else, really, but, yeah.
The album's called Fourth Corner. It is new from Trixie Whitley. Trixie, thanks so much for playing for us.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
This is Soundcheck.
Conflicted by the waste.
That's going to do it for Soundcheck today. On Monday, a conversation with two of the five original MTV VJs, Mark Goodman and Nina Blackwood. They're the subjects of a new book called VJ, The Unplugged Adventures of MTV's First Wave. Also, an in-studio performance from Christina Pato. She is perhaps the world's foremost player of the Galician bagpipe from the Celtic region of Spain. I'm John Schaefer. Have a great weekend. We'll see you back here at 9 on Monday. This is Soundcheck.